Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Aunt Canary. It's 8:03 on the East Coast, December 13, 2016. Welcome to the experience where I want you to assume nothing, question everything, and start thinking. That's the plan. If you want to call in tonight, call in number 914-803-4571. We do have a new call-in number, but I haven't memorized it yet, but I think this one's still working. Also, if you want to listen and chat, the chat room is open, so if you want to ask questions, comments, whatever, feel free to do that. We're going to keep this a tight show tonight because we're going to end at about 10 o'clock because contrary to what some people may think, black people work too, and I have to work early in the morning. So the show still goes on even though I have to get up early, and we're going to do the show, ended at 10, but in the meantime, I'm going to try to drop some information on you, drop some knowledge on you, and all that good stuff. So let me give you the title of the show tonight. The title of the show tonight is The Colonization of Africa. It follows up last week's show where I talked about Africa, gave some facts about Africa. We're going to talk about how colonization affected Africa to this day, and we also want to talk about a little-known fact about Africa about some dude named King Leopold II of Belgium and how he pretty much used the Congo as his own personal ATM machine and all the atrocities that he caused and all that stuff. And last week had someone, I don't know if they were doing it on purpose or whatever, praising King Leopold. This guy has got nothing to be praised about. So we're going to talk about that also. Like I said, the chat room is open. So if you want to send in questions or whatever, feel free. Call in number 914-803-4571. I'm going to play the ad. Then I'm going to get into my weekly diss of some people's president-elect. And then we're going to jump right into the program. Try to end this on a note that's information, because that's what this show is all about. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play the commercial, then I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Peace and blessings, family. My name is Pamela Muhammad, and this is the Initiative Radio Network. Our program lineup is as follows. On Sundays at 3 p.m., we have Remnant Peculiar Israelites, hosted by Sister Shamika. On Mondays at 8 p.m., we have Keeping It Live Radio, hosted by Sister Phyllis. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m., we have the Aunt Canary Experience, hosted by Brother Anthony. On Wednesdays at 8 p.m., we have Who Did It To You? Roundtable Discussion with yours truly, Kamala Muhammad, Brother Dr. James Jones, and moderated by Brother Maurice Muhammad. On Thursdays at 8 p.m., we have Global Outreach, hosted by Sister Rhonda Michelle. And on Fridays at 9 p.m., we have Just Us Creating Economic Self-Sufficiency, hosted by Brother John. We believe at the Initiative Radio Network that we must create an environment where we can do for self and go to war against anybody who comes against what we decide to build. Trust and believe. We love you, Black people, and we are giving our lives to make you free. Truth has come to you.
Okay. That was our ad, and I hope everybody listened to it and enjoyed it. We do have shows on every night of the week, so if you can, feel free to join us, call in, questions, whatever. We're doing this to try to wake people up because there's all kinds of stuff going on in this world, and some people would rather just cover their heads up and pretend that they don't exist. While here at the network, we confront this kind of stuff, so that's why we're here. So please join us every night of the week for a good topic, interesting programs, and all that good stuff. If you've been listening to me for a while, you know that when I get to this part of the program, this is your favorite part. To some of you, probably not, but this is a weekly Trump diss. Because, you know, if you're new to the show, you probably, why is he playing that song? Well, that's Trump, in my opinion. That's his new theme song. It's not Hail to the Chief. Because from what little bit I've seen so far, it's going to be the next 4 years are going to be a hot mess. And if I'm wrong, I will come out and say I'm wrong. But until then, he's got to prove otherwise. So what I'll do in this portion before I get to the topic of the night, I bring up a clip or talk about something he said or he did or whatever. And This is a clip by Cornel West, and he's going to talk about some of the things that we need to pay attention about Donald Trump. It's about a 10-minute clip, and it's very interesting. And if you watch the news today, he had at Trump Tower, he had some very prominent black figures go up and talk to him. Kanye West popped in for a visit. Ray Lewis popped in for a visit, and the great Jim Brown popped in for a visit. Don't know what they talked about or whatever, but we'll see what happens out of this. I think a lot of this is a smokescreen to he's trying to pull the okie doke again. He wants us to look at one thing while he's got something else going on in the background. And I think a lot of this is just a lot of BS. So we'll see what happens. Like I said, if I'm wrong, I will get on this program and say that, and I would apologize. But until then, nah, I'm not falling for it. So this is Dr. Cornel West talking about Trump. And then as soon as this clip is over, we're going to get into the topic of tonight, the colonization of Africa.
Wall Street wins again as Trump chooses bankers and billionaires. That was the headline in a piece by Bloomberg on Wednesday, shortly after Donald Trump tapped former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin to be his Treasury Secretary and billionaire investor Wilbur Ross to head the Commerce Department. This comes as Politico is reporting Trump is also considering Goldman Sachs President Gary Cohen for a top post. The two met at Trump Tower on Tuesday. Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, is also a former Goldman Sachs vice president who went on to head the right-wing Breitbart news site.
Wall Street has celebrated the news. On Wednesday, Goldman Sachs stock jumped 3.6% to an eight-year high. This all comes after Donald Trump campaigned on an anti-establishment message, often publicly criticizing his opponents for their ties to Goldman Sachs. Here's Trump speaking about Ted Cruz 10 months ago.
What he wanted to do is say, I will protect you from Goldman Sachs. I will protect you from Citibank. And I will protect you for the banks because I'm Robin Hood and I'm this wonderful senator and I'm going to protect you for these banks. And then he's borrowing from the banks. And by the way, he's got personal guarantees and he got low interest loans. Got low interest loans, low interest. And now he's going to go after Goldman Sachs. Doesn't work that way. Goldman Sachs owns him. Remember that, folks. They own him.
On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, the ranking member of the Senate Banking Committee, criticized Donald Trump for picking former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin to be Treasury Secretary. Brown said, quote, President-elect Trump campaigned against big money's power in Washington and accused Wall Street and hedge funds of getting away with murder, but now he's picked a hedge fund manager whose Wall Street ties couldn't run deeper to lead the Treasury Department, which is exactly what this election showed the American people don't want. This isn't draining the swamp, it's stocking it with alligators. The words of Senator Sherrod Brown.
Well, to talk more about the election of Donald Trump, his cabinet picks, and much more, we're joined by Cornel West, professor emeritus at Princeton University. During the Democratic primary, he endorsed Bernie Sanders after Hillary Clinton won the nomination. West made headlines when he endorsed Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Cornel. It's great to have you with us.
I just thank God for Democracy Now because journalism is almost dead as we move into this neo-fascist age, and thank God you all are still willing to tell the truth.
Well, your response to the election of Donald Trump and now the cabinet he is appointing around him?
Well, I think he's already betrayed working people in terms of making sure, in his view, that Wall Street is in the driver's seat. And what I mean by that is that in a emerging neo-fascist moment, you have the rule of big business, which is big banks and big corporations. You scapegoat the most vulnerable. It could be Muslims, Mexicans, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, indigenous peoples, black people, Jews, and so on. And then you also have militaristic orientations around the world. And so you see the extension of the repressive apparatus as those of us who hit the streets, those of us who have been willing to go to jail, we've had to recognize we'll have more coming at us under Trump administration. But the crucial thing is that he had talked about his connection with working people, and it's clear that the 1% are still running things.
You've also said, Dr. West, you just said that his administration will be neo-fascist. Could
That's
you
right.
explain, what do you mean by that? Neo-fascist as opposed to fascist, and what the two mean?
Well, neo-fascist is it's an American-style form of fascism, and what I mean by that is we've had a neoliberal rule from Carter to Obama. That neoliberal rule left in place a national security state. It left in place massive surveillance. It left in place the ability of the president to kill an American citizen with no due process. That's Obama. That was the culmination of the neoliberal era. Now you get someone who's narcissistic, which is to say out of control psychologically, who is ideologically confused, which is to say in over his head. And who does he choose? The most right-wing reactionary zealots, which lead toward the arbitrary deployment of law, which is what neo-fascism is, but to reinforce corporate interests, big bank interests, and to keep track of those of us who are cast as other, people of color, women, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Mexicans, and so forth and so on. So this is one of the most frightening moments in the history of this very fragile empire and fragile republic.
So I want to talk about some of the picks of Donald Trump, like President-elect Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. Deep ties to Wall Street, including working as a partner for Goldman Sachs, where his father also worked. Mnuchin's hedge fund also played a role in the housing crisis after it scooped up the failing California bank IndyMac in 2008. Under Mnuchin's ownership, IndyMac foreclosed on 36,000 families, particularly elderly residents trapped in reverse mortgages. People would go to Mnuchin's home to protest outside as they were foreclosed out of their own homes. Mnuchin was accused of running a foreclosure machine. The bank, which was renamed One West, was also accused of racially discriminatory lending practices. In 2015, Mnuchin sold the bank for $3.4 billion, $1.8 billion more than he bought it for.
This is what you call spiritual blackout. There's a level of callousness. There's a level of indifference toward poor and working people, preoccupation with greed, and most importantly, lack of accountability, doing anything they can do unless in the end they get caught by the law. And, of course, oftentimes they've already disproportionately influenced those who apply the law, those who are supposed to be regulating them. And so this is another instance of Wall Street run amok. I mean, I and some of us were very critical, the Adolph Reeds and others, very critical of Geithner, Summers, the Rubin crowd, straight out of Wall Street when Brother Barack Obama moved into the White House.
Summers, who you know well because he was president of Harvard when you were a professor
Absolutely.
There, and gotten a bit of an altercation with him.
Bless his soul. But so that you can see under the neoliberal rule, Wall Street's still in the driver's seat. We were hoping with Brother Bernie Sanders that we could bring the neoliberal era to a close. And by neoliberal, what I mean is when you see a social problem, you financialize, you privatize, and militarize. So you get mass incarceration on the one hand, privatized schools. I know Sister Diane Rabbit's one of the great prophetic voices of our time in this regard. We'll talk about this later. And then you militarize, which is to say, drop bombs on seven Muslim countries and then wonder why Muslims are upset. So, or you drop bombs on innocent children with U.S. drones and then wonder why the gangsters, the fascists coming out of the Muslim world are organizing. And, of course, we got to be anti-fascist across the board. But this is going to be the most trying of times in our lifetime. There's no doubt about it. And at 63 years old, I am thoroughly fortified for this fight, I'll tell you that.
Well, given the people who voted for Trump, and continuing with what you said, many have questioned how Trump, who after all is a billionaire born into a wealthy family, how did he become a working class hero so widely perceived among the people who voted for him as someone outside of the American economic and political elite class?
A significant number of those who voted for Trump were actually working people, middle-class people who are looking for a way out, given the fact that they're losers under neoliberal globalization. And they tilted toward Bernie Sanders, but the Democratic Party and its neoliberal regime marginalize him and us. And so the only alternative is this pseudo-populist billionaire with these narcissistic sensibilities and fascist, neo-fascist proclivities. And he presented himself as caring for their situation. And so that economic insecurity, that economic neglect is very real. There's no doubt about that. And it's disproportionately white brothers and sisters, but they are suffering. And it was a cry of the heart. Unfortunately, given the right-wing populist and authoritarian orientation of Trump, he uses that kind of anguish to scapegoat Mexicans, Muslims, and others rather than confront the most powerful. 21% of those who voted for Trump do not like him, but they feel as if they had no alternative. And we have to keep in mind 42% of our fellow citizens didn't go to the polls at all. They've already given up on the system, you see. And so the system itself now is in such a chronic crisis. And we had said before the election that Trump would be a neo-fascist catastrophe. And it's very clear from his picks that he's moving in that direction.
That was very, very interesting, what Dr. Cornel West had to say. So that's why I want to play it, give you another I'm going to keep this, and matter of fact, I'm going to keep this going every week that I have a show until he's out of office. So if you're new to the show, you have that too, you'll be expecting that out of me. And if you've been here for a while, well, you've been here for a while, so you know what's already going to happen. So I just want to play that, get that played for you. And now we're going to get into the topic tonight, which is the colonization of Africa. I'm going to give you a few facts, and then we're going to play the clips to give you some more information. Let's see, the history of external colonization of Africa can be divided into two stages, classical antiquity and European colonization. In popular parlance, discussions of colonization in Africa usually focus on the European conquest that resulted in the scramble for Africa after the Berlin Conference in the 19th century. As a matter of fact, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, the European conquest. In nearly all African countries today, the language used in government and media is a relic inherited from one of these waves of colonism. The existence of a vast African dyspatia, I think I said it right, is largely the legacy of the practice of transporting millions of African slaves out of the continent by these external colonizers. Some modern scholars also blame the current underdevelopment of Africa on the colonial era. Okay. Chronological overview. In ancient times, people from Southern Europe and Western Asia colonized North Africa, while people from Southern Asia colonized Madagascar. In the Middle Ages, North and East Africa were further colonized by people from Western Asia. In the modern era, Western Europeans colonized all parts of the continent, culminating in the scramble for Africa in the late 19th century. A wave of decolonization followed after World War II. The main instance of internal colonization within the African continent was the Bantu migration. A few more facts. Like I said, we're not going to talk about the ancient colonization. That's for, excuse me, that'd be for another show. But what we want to talk about tonight is the European colonization. Established empires, notably Britain, Portugal, and France, had already claimed for themselves vast areas of Africa and Asia, and emerging imperial powers like Italy and Germany had done likewise on a smaller scale. With the dismissal of the Asian Chancellor Bismarck by Kaiser Wilhelm II, the relatively orderly colonization became a frantic scramble. The 1884 Berlin Conference, initiated by Bismarck to establish international guidelines for the acquisition of African territory, formalized this, quote, new imperialism, unquote. Between the Franco-Persian War and the Great War, Europe had added almost 9 million square miles, one-fifth of the land area of the globe, to its overseas colonial possessions. A few more. Let's see. Let me grab my paper. A few more facts on this. Let me see. Oh, let me grab this one. Okay. Trying to see what to give you the meat of this. France Rude from France, appointing chiefs individually without considering traditional criteria, but rather loyalty to France. France established two large colonial federations in Africa, French West Africa and French Equatorial Africa. France appointed officials, passed laws, and had to approve any measures passed by colonial assemblies. Local groups in Germany and German East Africa resisted German enforced labor and taxation. The Germans were almost driven out of the area in 1888. A decade later, the colony seemed conquered, though, quote, it had been a long drawn out struggle, and inland administration centers were in reality little more than a series of small military fortresses, end quote. In 1905, the Germans were astonished by a widely supported uprising. This resilience was at first successful. However, within a year, the insurgency was suppressed by reinforcing troops armed with machine guns. German attempts to seize control of Southwest Africa also produced ardent resistance, which was very forcefully put down. King Leopold II of Belgium called his vast private colony the Congo Free State. Effectively, this meant those exploiting the area were free from all restraint and answerable only to the Belgian king. The treatment of the Africans under the system was harsh enough to cause the other colonial powers to plead with the Belgian king to exercise more moderating influence. Eventually, the Belgian government annexed the territory as a Belgian colony. And we're going to talk about King Leopold in just a second on what his on the way he ruled and how it affected the country. This is about decolonization. Let me get to good stuff about this. Vincent Poya, I think I'm saying it right, notes the significant resistance imperialist powers faced to their domination in Africa. Technical superiority enabled conquest and control. Pro-independence Africans reorganized the value of European education in dealing with Europeans in Africa. Some Africans established their own churches. Africans also noted the unequal evidences of gratitude they received for the efforts to support imperialist countries during the world wars. He also notes that while European imposed borders did not correspond to traditional territories, such as new territories provided entries to to focus efforts by movements for increased political voice up to independence. Among local groups so concerned were professionals such as lawyers and doctors, the petite bourgeoisie, clerks, teachers, small merchants, urban workers, cash crop farmers, peasant farmers, trade unions, and other initially non-political associations evolved into political movements. So in other words, the states of Africa started to push back on the colonizers. The main period of decolonization in Africa began after World War II. Growing independence movements, indigenous political parties, and trade unions, coupled with pressure from within the imperialist powers and from the United States, ensured the decolonization of the majority of the continent by 1980. While some areas, in particular South Africa, remain a large population of Europe descent, only the Spanish enclaves of Ceuta and Melilla and the islands of Reunion, I think I'm saying it right, the Canary Islands, and Madeira remain under European control. And I'm sorry if I butchered some of those names toward the end. I'm going to play some clips for you that will give you a little bit more information on the colonization of Africa. Matter of fact, the first clip I'm going to play is entitled The Colonization of Africa.
In this video, we're going to do a brief overview of European colonization of Africa. and just kind of set the stage for the document work and the discussions that we're going to have in class over the next couple days. So let's talk about African colonization. In 1875, 10% of Africa was colonized, only 10%. 10 years later, or even, it says 1900, but really only 10 years later, 90% of the continent is colonized by Europe. So this is a very quick, a very rapid, a very tense scramble for Africa, as we call it. So the scramble for African territory begins in 1879, when Henry Stanley, the same explorer who found Dr. David Livingston, claims Congo for King Leopold II of Belgium, and this kicks off the whole scramble. By the way, Congo, 80 times the size of Belgium. So keep that in mind. I want you to brainstorm between now and class. Why do you think Belgium, a tiny country that we barely ever talk about so far in this course, is able to take a colony and control a colony that's 80 times the size of the mother country? So let's talk about Belgian Congo for a second. Belgian Congo is actually Leopold's personal colony. So it wasn't actually controlled by Belgium as a country, but rather it was his personal colony for which he was, I'll let you be the judge. At first he says he would use it for research. Remember, this is a time period of lots of new medical advances, Joseph Lister, Louis Pasteur. So Leopold says he wants to use this as a research colony, as a place to research diseases and possible treatments and medicines for those diseases. What actually happens is he uses this to make money, to make a personal profit. There's a lot of resources like rubber, for example, and diamonds and gold. So with that, they treat the people of Africa who are forced into the labor very rough, and they are tortured and they are intimidated. You'll read in a document, for example, that a man's family gets kidnapped and they won't release the family until he produces enough rubber for the Belgian officers. So this is not what Leopold said he would originally do with that colony. The problem here, though, is that if you're another European country and you see how much money is being made in Belgian Congo, you can't resist trying to grab your own colony, because remember that Europe is highly competitive at this time. Each country's jockeying for position and try to be the most powerful country in the continent, and any money that they could make and any power they could get from these colonies would certainly help that competition. So other Europeans see what's going on in the Belgian Congo and they want in, and this leads to the scramble for Africa, or as Leopold calls it, the delicious cake of Africa. So the scramble for Africa causes a lot of tension between countries. It's like they're rushing for a limited resource, and you don't want to be the country that gets stuck with no colony in Africa. Now, as you can imagine, everybody making a mad dash for colonies creates tension, and a lot of people thought that this might actually be the beginning of what would become World War I. But at the last moment, they're able to sit down in Berlin in Germany in 1885 and try to work out a solution where everybody comes away with something on the continent. And that meeting is called the Berlin Conference of 1885. And at this conference, the European countries sat down and they literally sat over a map and carved up the continent amongst all the European powers. Now check out these maps right here. This insert map below, okay? 10% of Africa colonized. All of this gray area was not colonized by Europe in just 1878. Just some colonies along port areas and along the coast that had existed for a long time before this, but other than that, the continent was wide open. Then we look at 1885, right? 1885, less than 10 years later, 90% of the continent is colonized. With only two exceptions, the colonies are all claimed by Europe. One exception is over here in West Africa. Liberia is created as an independent nation after the U.S. Civil War for slaves to relocate back to their heritage. And over here in the Horn of Africa is Ethiopia. We'll talk about them in a minute, but they're able to resist colonization. Everybody else is colonized. By the way, no Africans at this meeting. These African people did not have a say over whether or not their country would be, their nations would be colonized, and how that would go down. So there are a couple of different ways to rule these colonies. One is direct rule, where Europeans live in the colony and hold all the power. Africans have no power in this model. And then there's indirect rule, where local people are allowed to rule in the colony and answer to the mother country. Don't be fooled. This doesn't mean that local people had a lot of rights. It just meant that they were given a little bit of power, even if it wasn't real power. At the end of the day, the mother country still called all the important shots in the colony. And then there's also the issue of assimilation. In Algeria, for example, the French tried to assimilate Algerians into French culture, and they are met with resistance. And then there's paternalism, which is when you treat the people of the colonies like they're kids who don't know any better, and the mother country is a parent who provides for them, barely, but denies them rights because they just don't know what they're doing. So very quickly, let's go around the continent. In North Africa, France claims Morocco and Algeria, tries to assimilate them into French culture, make them speak French, make them Catholic or Protestant even, but mostly Catholic. But the people of Algeria and Morocco, they resist this, and it brings quite a bit of violence through resistance. Egypt, also another colony in North Africa, an important one, is a protectorate of Great Britain, meaning that there was indirect rule by the British. That will change, as we'll talk about it more in more detail when we get to the Middle East. More colonies, all of sub-Saharan Africa, so anything south of the Sahara Desert is colonized. Local leaders cut deals for some power, but again, it wasn't really a big deal. Not a lot of decisions being made by them that are important. People are abused, they are denied their rights, and we'll see many examples of that in the primary source documents in class. All the while, Europeans are making a lot of money off their African colonies because there are new markets for them to sell their manufactured goods, but also because of the raw materials that they're able to take from the continent. Ethiopia is the one example, and we'll talk about this more in class, but King Menelik II is able to resist Italian occupation for two reasons. One, he knows the geography very well, and he lures the Italian army into the mountains and then attacks them guerrilla style. And when he does that, he uses modern weapons that he is able to buy from France and Russia. So by doing so, he's able to resist Italian occupation, at least for the time being. South Africa is an interesting situation because before the Conference of Berlin, it was already settled by Dutch Boers, who were farmers, and they had been there for quite some time. They clashed with the Zulu, the local people of South Africa, but this gets an interesting spin when Great Britain is given South Africa at the Berlin Conference, and especially this becomes especially tense when it is discovered that there are a lot of diamonds and lots of diamond mines and diamond fields in South Africa. And this leads to the Boer War, which is a war between the British and the Boers with the Zulu caught up in the middle. And the British end up winning this war and keeping this territory. They cut some deals with the Boers over sharing land, but the diamonds really mostly become property of the British. And Cecil Rhodes is a capitalist from Great Britain, and he benefits greatly from the diamond mines in South Africa. He loves imperialism because he makes a ton of money off of it. And he controlled 90% of the Kimberley diamond mines, which contained most of the diamonds in the world. So obviously, if something makes you very wealthy, you're going to be very much in support of it. And Cecil Rhodes was a strong supporter of imperialism and believed that the British should control an empire in Africa that goes from Cape Town, South Africa, all the way to Cairo, Egypt, as you can see in this political cartoon with Cecil Rhodes' feet on each of those cities. So here are the essential questions we need to consider when we study Africa this week. Well, how was imperialism different in the various African colonies? You'll see that the way the methods of control and the reasons for taking the colonies are quite different from region to region. How did imperialism impact the people of the colonies? You'll see a lot of similarities and a few differences, and most of the impact will be negative, as we see. But let's see if we can find some evidence to support that. And then lastly, what, if any, obligations did the Europeans have to the people of Africa? Something that you may notice as we go along is they're not necessarily providing infrastructure. They're not providing an education. So what is the benefit, if any, for the people of Africa? Or at least, what is the benefit from the perspective of the year?
Okay, that was the first clip talking about the colonization of Africa. So right now I'm going to take my first call. First, matter of fact, I think this is Brother Mohammed. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Peace and blessings, Brother Anthony. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. I'm glad I caught the program. I see they starting out real early, because you're getting questions rolling into my phone already.
Oh, man. Well,
wow.
I think that's I guess I'm going to take that as something good, which is, you know.
Definitely.
Which is, yeah, good. Yeah, good. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, because my thing, you know, with these programs, you know, I noticed that, you know, whenever you know, me or anybody else, whenever we talk about race, we talk about slavery, we talk about, you know, discrimination, whenever we bring up these racism, whenever we talk about these topics, you know, you have some people saying, you know, why don't you people, you know, the heck so long ago, why else to talk about it? And my thing is, you know,
mm-hmm.
do you tell Jews to forget about the Holocaust? No, you don't. So we shouldn't forget about this
That's
kind of
right.
stuff because it's important. It's history. And we're going to keep talking about
mm-hmm.
it, even though some people want us to brush it up under the rug and forget about it. You know, they get mad at us that we talk about it. You know, my thing is, won't you get mad at the racists that are still running around spewing garbage? But they won't get mad at
mm-hmm.
the racist people. They get mad at us for talking about this and then bringing it up and, you know, and bringing it to the light and talking
mm-hmm.
about it. You know,
mm-hmm.
which is amazing to me. It's amazing to me that, you know, this is history, and this is history that, you know, is not taught in school, but, you know, we need to talk about it anyway, but then people get mad about it. You know, don't get mad at me. I mean, it's already been done. It's history.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, it's in the past. It's been done. Don't get mad at me because I'm bringing it out and I'm talking about it. You know,
exactly.
And I think
exactly.
that's, and I think that's what, you know, and I don't understand it. I really don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get it. I'm guessing it's probably
mm-hmm.
from guilt, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, they feel, you know, they feel something, some kind of guilt into this. And then all of a sudden
mm-hmm.
we start talking about it, and all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, you shouldn't talk about it. Well, we're going to keep talking about
exactly.
it. Exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what,
you know, we got to know what happened. We got to know who did it to us. You know, because when you think about it, as the clip you just got finished playing, and the guy was talking about, you know, the white people in South Africa, and black people got to know, well, damn, how did the white folks come to power in South Africa if it was more black people than white people? How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yep.
those questions have to be answered. Because people actually want to know, well, what happened? How did they come and get power? How did they come and make you Christian? How did you become a Catholic? Or how did you become this? Or how did you become that? You know, what happened to us? You know, we were talking at work today, and, you know, one of my coworkers that from Nigeria had nerve to say, well, you know, back in slavery, from what I understand, that black people had slaves too in America. And I'm like, say what? He was like, yeah, black people had slaves in America. I said, bro, that don't even make common sense. If we think about it, they black people had no rights. So if you a black person with property, you got a house and you got land, which white person do you know that's not going to come and take it from you? They going to take it from you because you a nigga. And a nigga
yep.
ain't got no right. A nigga damn sure ain't got no right to own no property. No.
Yep.
So I said, that's not true. That's bullshit. That's lies.
Yep.
You know, and they talk about, well, what about John somebody? He was like, he was the first black president before Obama. I said, what?
Yeah, I heard
what,
that.
When was this?
Yeah.
You know, we're giving
yeah.
the 18 something. I'm like, come on. Do that make sense? Again, 1800s, they were hanging niggas.
Mm-hmm.
We were still in slavery. There's no way
yep.
in the world they're going to have a black man as the president of the United States of America during slavery. Ain't no way, man.
Yep.
That don't even make sense. You know, but, you know,
yep.
people put this foolishness out there, and people think about it and go, yeah, that's right. You know, yeah, Obama wasn't the first black president. This guy was the first black president. Come on, man, that don't even make common sense. You know,
yep.
they put out so much disinformation to make you think one way, and the shit is wrong. You know, so we got to have truth so we'll know exactly what happened, how did it happen, you know, what's our way out, where do we go from here? So that's why it's really important, the program that you're doing. And I'm definitely happy that you're taking it upon yourself to get this information out to our people so that we can make better decisions as a people. Because right now, you know, we're not making good decisions, not as a people. As individuals, yeah, we make great decisions. But as a people, we don't make good decisions. So this program is definitely needed so we can understand what happened. And, you know, you just going through the you talked about white guilt, and that's one of the questions that these people are asking about white guilt. But, you know, we'll get to that when you get to your question and answer part.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Excellent.
That'll work.
Keep it up, bro. Keep it up.
That'll work. I appreciate it.
That's why you get the listeners that you get. I mean, 1,800 people on one goddamn program? Look what you're doing. Shit, don't change a goddamn thing. Tell them people that you kiss your ass. You doing your job. Hell, 1,800? Shit. Yes, sir. Yeah, okay. That's actual facts. That's actual facts.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're doing what you're supposed to do. And you keep it up, soldier.
Yep.
You keep it up.
I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do my best. And I do remember that program. That was on the Coon caricature. And I was talking about certain the history of coonage in this country. So I'm kind of shocked that, you know, got that number. But I guess somebody was listening that night, which is all good. But, yeah, I just want to get back to a couple of points that you made. And I'm going to play this next clip. I did hear something about some story about, you know, his first name is John something. I'm going to look him up. But there were claims made that he was the first black president, which are false. And there are also claims about, you know, black people owning slaves. And I think in one program I did, I kind of touched on that aspect, which, I'm not going to say it did or didn't happen, but it didn't happen to the point that a lot of people believe it happened. And I think a lot of those stories are just made up to try to cover up other things that were going on in the country or something that happened, you know, because most of the slavery done slave owners are white people, but you know, somebody said, hey, well, let's say this in order to kind of counterbalance the other thing. Which, no, you can't do that because, you know, you have to remember that the land in this country was taken by white folk. They came over and they took everything. They took all the land. And then to sit up here and say that a black guy actually owned land and then owned black slaves at the time when there was slavery going on by white people, really? You know, think about that logically. Think about, you know, you got a great big piece of land owned by a black guy and surrounded by him are other white guys with slaves. You really think that happened? That these other guys didn't look at this ain't gonna work. We gonna take what this guy's got. Really? Because they came over and took everything else. So why are they gonna let this one black guy have the same thing that they have? You know, because back in the day, land equaled power and power equaled money and all that kind of stuff. So why are they gonna share that kind of power and money and prestige with a black guy? Nah. When they could easily just go in and take his stuff and make him a slave. So that's pretty much impossible. But I will make a note of that, and I will probably bring that up on a later show. So I will do that. In the meantime, I'm going to play clip number two, which is entitled The Scramble for Africa and the Berlin Conference. And this isn't a very long clip, but it's got information, so I'm going to play it.
The Scramble for Africa and the Berlin Conference. What was the Scramble for Africa? In the 1800s, European countries were rushing into Africa to plant their flags in the land and claim colonies. Because of industrialization, Europe wanted Africa's valuable resources. Some of these included palm oil, cotton, gold, diamonds, and rubber. The control of the Suez Canal was also extremely important for countries wishing to trade with India and China. Overall, the Europeans thought the more colonies they had, the larger their military would be, making them a more powerful country. In the midst of this scramble to place flags on crucial African lands, disputes popped up over who had the best claim. When this began to disrupt trade and travel, Otto von Bismarck called together a meeting called the Berlin Conference. In 1884, 14 countries, minus anyone from Africa, met in Berlin. The major countries at the conference were Britain, France, Belgium, and Portugal. These countries gained much of the most strategic pieces of land. The French gained control of northwestern Africa, including Algeria. The British had control of both South Africa and Egypt, which included influence over the Suez Canal. King Leopold II of Belgium gained the Congo and Central Africa, and the Portuguese established their control of the western and eastern edges of Africa. So what effect did this have on the native African population? While Europe having their primary goal to be the end of slavery in Africa, their actions resulted in the increase in the women and children slaves. They also claimed to be the most civilized, but in reality they carried out horrible travesties in their colonies. In particular, in King Leopold II's Congo River Basin, over 5 million were murdered and hundreds had their hands chopped off. Europeans also arbitrarily drew boundaries without any regard for the local people groups. It was common for the controlling European power to exploit any existing animosity between people groups in order to keep the population divided and weak. This led to countless disputes, civil wars, and even genocides. You might recall the recent stories of thousands upon thousands murdered in the Sudanese Civil War and the ongoing conflict between the Hutus and Tutsis in the Darfur massacre. The Industrial Revolution in Europe pushed countries to acquire colonies which could supply raw materials while at the same time becoming a captured market to sell their manufactured goods. This rush for colonies, aka the scramble for Africa, led to the drawing of arbitrary boundary lines, resulting in tragic unintended consequences that are still affecting Africa today.
Okay, that was clip number two, just a little bit more information on the scramble for Africa. Now, the next couple of clips, I've got a couple more clips to play, then we'll get to the questions and answers and all that kind of stuff. But these next couple of clips are about Leopold II of Belgium. Now, until recently when I was doing research on this, I had never heard of this guy before. And I was sitting there reading this. I was trying to remember if we had ever talked about this guy in school, and I don't think we did. You got to remember when I went to school, unfortunately, I was talking to somebody about this before. I always knew that it was almost the end of the year is when we got to the chapter in the history book about Africa, usually around April or May. Whenever we got into that part of the book, I was like, well, it's almost time to get out of school, because we never talked about that a whole lot. Unfortunately, a lot of that, it's like, you know, they would, you know, whenever they started talking about this, it was like it always started with slavery, and then they would throw in a few more things, and that was basically it. But they never talked about Leopold II of Belgium, and we're going to talk about him. I'm going to give you some background on him, and these clips that I've got on him are very interesting clips on him. And for the listener last week that wanted to, I'm guessing either out of trying to be a non-funny comedian or an ignorant person, kept talking about that Leopold was a great leader and blah, blah, blah. I don't remember exactly what he said, but that's pretty much BS. And I'm about to call BS on him in just a second. Let me give out the call-in number just to, if you want to call in on this. 914-803-4571, 914-803-4571. And we're going to talk about Leopold II of Belgium. Now, this guy, he was the second king of the Belgians. He was known for founding an exploitation of the Congo Free State as a private venture. Born in Brussels and the second, but eldest surviving son of Leopold I and Louise of Orleans. I'm not going to get into all that blah, blah, blah. But what made this guy, I don't know, part of history or historical or whatever? He was the founder and sole owner of the Congo Free State, a private project undertaken on his own behalf. He used explorer Henry Morton Stanley to help him lay claim to the Congo, an area now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. At the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885, the colonial nations of Europe authorized his claim by committing the Congo Free State to improving the lives of the native inhabitants. From the beginning, however, Leopold essentially ignored these conditions. He ran the Congo using the mercenary force publique for his own personal enrichment. He used great sums of money from this exploitation for public and private construction projects in Belgium during this period. He donated the private buildings to the state before his death to preserve them for Belgium. Leopold extracted a fortune from the Congo, initially by the collection of ivory, and after a rise in the price of rubber in the 1890s, by forced labor from the natives to harvest and process rubber. Under his regime, millions of the Congolese people died. Modern estimates range from 2 to 15 million. Let me say that again, 2 to 15 million with an M, with a consensus growing around 10 million. Let me say that again, with a consensus growing around 10 million. These are people, 2 to 15, and people, and they round it around 10 million people that this guy had to do with their killing. Human rights abuses under his regime contributed significantly to these deaths. Reports of death and abuse led to a major international scandal in the early 20th century, and Leopold was ultimately forced by the Belgian government to relinquish control of the colony to the civil administration in 1908. Now, I'm not going to get into a lot of his early background and all that kind of mess and marriage and all that. No, I'm not going to get into that. What I'm going to talk about is what he did and the Congo. Like I said, he was the ruler of Belgium for about, he ruled from 17 December 1865 to 17 December 1909. His reign in the Congo Free State was from July 1st, 1885 to 15 November 1908. See what he did because he did some pretty nasty stuff. Let's talk about the Congo Free State. Leopold was the founder and sole owner of the Congo Free State and all its people, a private project undertaken on his own behalf. He used, like I said, he used explorer Stanley to help lay claim. At the Belgian Conference is where he got the permission to do what he wanted to. He got the ivory, he got the rubber, and a little bit more about this. Leopold fervently believed that overseas colonies were the key to a country's greatness, and he worked tirelessly to acquire colonial territory for Belgium. Leopold eventually began to acquire a colony as a private citizen. The Belgian government lent him money for this venture. In 1866, Leopold instructed the Belgian ambassador in Madrid to speak to Queen Isabella II of Spain about ceding the Philippines to Belgium. However, knowing the situation fully, the ambassador did nothing. Leopold quickly replaced the ambassador with a more sympathetic individual to carry out his plan. In 1868, when Isabella II was deposed as Queen of Spain, Leopold tried to press his original plan to acquire the Philippines. But without funds, he was unsuccessful. Leopold then devised another unsuccessful plan to establish the Philippines as an independent state, which could then be ruled by a Belgian. When both of these plans failed, Leopold shifted his aspirations to colonization to Africa. After numerous unsuccessful schemes to acquire colonies in Africa and Asia, In 1876, Leopold organized a private holding company disguised as an international scientific and philanthropic association, which he called the International African Society, or the International Association for the Exploration and Civilization of the Congo. In 1878, under the auspices of the holding company, he hired the famous explorer Henry Stanley to explore and establish a colony in the Congo region. Much diplomatic maneuvering among European nations resulted in the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885 regarding African affairs, at which representatives of 14 European countries and the United States recognized Leopold as the sovereign of most of the area to which he and Stanley had laid claim. On February 5, 1885, the Congo Free State, an area 76 times larger than Belgium, was established under Leopold II's personal rule and private army, the Force Publique. He amassed a huge personal fortune by exploiting the natural resources of the Congo. At first, ivory was exported, but this did not yield the expected levels of revenue. When the global demand for rubber exploded, attention shifted to the labor-intensive collection of sap from rubber plants. Abandoning the promises of the Berlin Conference in the late 1890s, the Free State government restricted foreign access and extorted forced labor from the natives. Abuses, especially in the rubber industry, included the forced labor of the native population, beatings, widespread killings, and frequent mutilations when the production quotas were not met. Missionary John Harris of Baringa was so shocked by what he had come across that he wrote to Leopold's chief agent of the Congo saying, quote, "I have just returned from a journey inland to the island of Nsongo Boyo, I think I'm saying it right. The abject misery and the utter abandon is positively indescribable. I was so moved, Your Excellency, by the people's stories that I took the liberty of promising them that in the future you will only kill them for crimes they commit," end quote. And there were, you could get online and research this. There were, you know, you will find pictures of many of these people from Congo with their hands chopped off. Estimates of the death toll range from 1 million to 15 million since accurate records were not kept. They, you know, these are in the millions of, you know, not thousands, not hundreds, but millions. Let me see what else. You know, they roughly put it at about 10 million people died. Smallpox epidemics and sleeping sickness almost also devastated the population. So not only did he kill a lot of these people, the disease also killed them, killed a lot of the people also. So he was pretty much using the country as his own personal ATM machine. International opposition and criticism from both the Catholic Party and the Labor Party caused the Belgian Parliament to compel the king to cede the Congo Free State to Belgium in 1908. The Congo Free State was transformed into a Belgian colony, known as the Belgian colony under parliamentary control. After gaining its independence in the mid-20th century, it was renamed three times, first as Republic of the Congo, second as Zaire, and third as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. And he died on 17 December 1909, but not before he did his damage to this country. This clip that I'm going to play is called Leopold II of Belgium, Racism, Slavery, and Genocide in the Congo. It's not a very long clip, but it's got information. And then next clip I'll play after that, it's got a little bit more information. But this is about King Leopold II.
After the Conference of Berlin in 1885, Europeans embarked on a continent-wide land grab. In less than 20 years, 90% of African territory would be placed under European colonial rule. one of the main beneficiaries was King Leopold II of Belgium. Aware of a vast fortune to be made, he persuaded Europe's powers to recognize his sovereignty over one of Africa's largest regions, the Congo.
Here was this man who became King of Belgium in 1865 at the age of 30. Enormously shrewd, enormously greedy, enormously ambitious, and with an absolutely brilliant sense of public relations. He hired the explorer, Henry Morton Stanley, the man who found Livingston, to go to the Congo and essentially stake out this huge territory for him. Leopold got first the United States and then all the major nations of Western Europe to ratify his seizure of this enormous territory in the center of the continent.
First, Leopold created a smokescreen, claiming that he wished to educate a savage people.
They were already fooled by Leopold because they took him at his word. They thought he was a sort of a man who's going to lose all his money in this crazy philanthropic venture. But they didn't realize what he was really after at all, which was to make himself hugely rich by exploiting brown hands and broad backs who were going to carry the wealth of Africa and load it on ships for his own personal profit.
Bring them!
Extreme violence was employed to impose Leopold's dominion. The right hands of those who failed to meet rubber quotas were severed. Even young children were not spared. In 1896, a German newspaper reported that 1,308 hands had been gathered in one day. Leopold created a 90,000 strong army to enforce his rule. One of his lieutenants wrote, "Only the whip can civilize the black."
They would go into village after village. The army would seize the women of the village and hold them hostage in order to force the men of each village to go into the forest and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. And they did this for about 20 years. And you can just very easily imagine if you have a village where the women are all being held hostage, the men are all in the forest as forced laborers for several weeks out of each month. There's nobody to plant and harvest food, to go hunting, to go fishing, to do all the normal things through which a community feeds itself. So from all of these causes, starvation, being worked to death, and most of all from the disease that hit this famine-ridden population, the best estimates are that between 1880, when King Leopold first got his hands on the Congo, and 1920, that in that 40-year period, the population was slashed from about 20 million at the beginning of that period to around 10 million at the end. So, an enormous loss of human life.
Huge building projects throughout Belgium were funded by Leopold's wealth to celebrate his reign. Leopold built himself a palace, now called the Museum of Central Africa, to display his spoils. For historian Bambi Kuipins, whose father is Congolese, the building embodies the myths created to justify Belgian rule in the Congo.
The central hall gives you the idea of what the museum is supposed to be about. You have the central dome through which the light falls on the heart of darkness underneath, you can say. Simultaneously, the dome also presents the sky, God, and then in the central hall, underneath that representation of Leopold II, are statues of Congolese. So what you really see were the hierarchical relationships that structured the relations between the colonized and the colonizers. As a human being, I'm obviously shocked by that, because it is very clear that Africans the way that this museum was originally set up and the way that most of the exhibitions still work are really dehumanized because they were seen and represented as savages who really needed the help of outsiders, i.e. Europeans, to transform them into fully civilized human beings.
From the late 19th century onwards, human zoos exhibiting Africans in their primitive state became popular around Europe. One of the first was housed in the grounds of Leopold's museum.
The Africans were put on display so people could go and see them in very much the same way that they could look at, say, caged animals in a zoo, and their reactions were also very similar. There were notices saying that people were not allowed to throw peanuts at the Africans because that was what they did. This museum is also, in a very real sense, the only monument to Belgian colonial history left in this country. So if we dismantle the museum, there is a very great danger that we also eradicate the public memory of that colonial heritage. And once that happens, of course, one paves the way for all these people who say, well, it was not as bad as that, was it? And Leopold II really did do a great deal of good.
In 1908, the year before Leopold died, his crimes were made public and he was forced to hand control of the Congo over to the Belgian government. But the cruelty continued.
The forced labor system did not come to an end because it was so profitable. The new Belgian Congo continued it more or less until the early 1920s. At that point, the Belgian colonial officials realized that their population was shrinking so rapidly from the effects of the forced labor system that they had to modify it. They had to make it less lethal, or otherwise they would have no labor force left.
Although 10 million people died, the Congolese genocide has largely been forgotten in Europe. In the book, The Heart of Darkness, the author Joseph Conrad, who witnessed the violence in the Congo, writes, "The conquest of the earth, which mostly means taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much."
Now, before I play this very last clip, then I'm going to get into your questions, comments till about 10 o'clock. But I want you to remember what was said in that piece. They had zoos, not zoos with animals, but they had zoos with people. Look that up. If you don't believe that clip, believe what I'm saying, Google it. Look it up. That had people in it from Africa. Just like if you were going
In the heart of Africa lies the Congo, quenched by its flowing river, furnished by meandering hills, and endowed with a myriad of natural resources, including ivory, precious minerals, and rubber. On the far end of Europe is Belgium, one of the smallest and youngest countries in the continent, disjointed by the breadth of its cultural divergence and lacking the political and economic knowledge possessed by other European countries. On the 9th of April, 1835, a man was born in Brussels, Belgium, almost 4,000 miles from the Congo. In spite of the distance between the two nations, his effects on the Congo are undeniable. His exploitation and destruction of the region and its people engendered problems that persist even to this day. His name was Leopold II, King of the Belgians and conqueror of the Congo. King Leopold was born Leopold Louis Philippe Marie Victor, the son of Queen Louis Marie and King Leopold I. He was one of four children. As a boy, Leopold was shunned by his family. A nerve defect caused him to walk with a limp, and his long nose resulted in his own mother describing him as, quote-unquote, bird-like and deformed. Although he proved careless in his studies, Leopold did develop a fondness for two subjects in particular, geography and colonialism, an interest that would later manifest itself. Leopold served in the Belgian army through much of his early life, eventually achieving status as second lieutenant. In 1853, once Leopold had turned 18, his father decided that the time had come for his son to marry. The bride was Marie Henriette, Archduchess of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, chosen with the hopes of allying with her family's powerful nation. Their marriage, however, proved loveless and was not a top priority for Leopold. Leopold's desire to improve his own nation prompted him to explore the world in search of a president to increase Belgium's wealth and influence. For the next several years, Leopold traveled the world, visiting a multitude of nations, including Turkey, Palestine, India, Ceylon, and Sumatra. He grew convinced that a colony would transform his young nation into a superpower. Studying Spain, France, and England, he recognized the economic opportunities that imperialism presented. Leopold's search was temporarily interrupted in May of 1865. His father had become ill. On December 10th of that year, the king died, leaving Leopold II as the monarch of Belgium. For almost 20 years, Leopold pleaded with the Belgian parliament for rights to establish a colony. Realizing that his efforts were futile, he sought a new means of gaining affluence for Belgium, establishing his own private colony. Following the example of various other European nations, he turned his imperial interest to Africa, 80% of which had yet to be colonized. In September of 1876, Leopold encouraged major European powers to convene in Brussels to discuss Africa's future, at what became known as the Brussels Conference. Leopold called for forced eradication of the Arabic slave trade, hoping instead to westernize the continent and its people. Here, the International African Society was founded, with members including nations throughout Europe and even the United States. In January 1878, Leopold intercepted Henry Morton Stanley, a man famous for his quest to find Scottish missionary Dr. David Livingstone. Stanley soon consented to meet Leopold in Brussels. During the course of the meeting, Stanley agreed to a contract for his involvement in establishing Belgium's presence in the Congo.
The decision of Leopold to colonize the Congo should be put in its historical context, where Western European countries all were very ambitious to have colonies. And Leopold had the feeling that Belgium also needed that, and that he rendered excellent service to Belgium by giving it a colony.
He prompted Stanley to claim as much land as he could for Belgium and to establish a monopoly in the ivory and rubber trade. Through over 400 treaties, chiefs unknowingly ceded their land to Leopold. Through these treaties and other manipulation, Leopold gained over 2.3 million square kilometers of land for his colony, the Congo Free State. In order to abolish the Arab slave trade, Leopold organized a group of European army officers, who in turn drafted Congolese soldiers to serve in the state's militia, known as the Force Publique. However, the Force Publique was mainly used against the Congolese people. The abuses against the native people soon became evident in all regions of Congo Free State. State agents would arrive in villages with armed soldiers, demanding monthly payments of resources. Villagers would be put to work as laborers in European homes, as porters, or to work the land. In some places, villagers were forced to work for free. In others, children as young as 7 were sent to labor. Agents used brutal punishments and harsh laws, and although laws against brutality had been proposed in the Congo Free State, seldom were they enforced. Any district that failed to meet the requirements of goods for the day might be punished through public execution or village burning. The introduction of rubber to Europe was extremely consequential to the natives of the Congo Free State. By the mid-1890s, the Congo became one of the most prominent rubber exporters of the world. Each adult male in the Congo was to produce between 6 and 9 pounds of rubber every 2 weeks. The job was dangerous and difficult. Many died by falling out of the tall rubber trees or being attacked by leopards. One tactic agents used to encourage labor was seizing the women of the villages. The women were imprisoned until the village collected enough rubber, and many were raped by officers while in captivity. By the late 1890s, rubber was the most profitable resource in the Congo. As demands for this product grew, force publique agents became increasingly more brutal to the Africans. Armies often raided towns, seizing laborers and food, and any person who rebelled would be shot. The tradition of collecting hands was especially prominent in the Congo. This practice was initially started to keep track of how many people the troops killed, and to make sure bullets were not wasted. When excess bullets were utilized, agents were known for cutting the hands off of live victims. In Belgium, Leopold was engrossed in his newfound wealth. He used Congolese wood to decorate his home and began building projects in Belgium and France. Initially, the harsh conditions in the Congo were kept from Europe. However, as time passed, Congolese missionaries and cargomen began to write reports about the violence. Only for a brief time, however, were abuses ignored. More accounts of violence and torture began to come in, particularly from one man, Edmond Morel, a rubber exporter from France. After observing the torture and slave labor being executed in the Congo, Morel grew determined to inform the whole world of the atrocities he had witnessed. In 1903, Morel started his own publication, the West African Mail, in which he published articles written by himself, other cargo men and missionaries about the harsh conditions in the Congo. Another man, Roger Casement, was sent by the British Council to investigate the Congolese atrocities. In December of 1909, Leopold became ill, most likely with cancer. Doctors planned to operate on him. However, the day before the surgery, the king died. Before his death, Leopold ensured that all personal records of the Congo over the past 24 years were destroyed. In 1908, a year before Leopold's death, the Belgian government had annexed the Congo as a colony to the state. As a result of rebellion throughout the city of Leopoldville and the loss of Belgian interest, the colony eventually gained sovereignty in 1960. Belgium's sudden withdrawal left the newly freed Republic of Congo in a volatile state. Now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the nation is engrossed in a continuing conflict.
One of the main characteristics today of the Congo is its chaotic situation. Since the disappearance of the Mobutu regime, the country has been going through civil war and is still, in the eastern part, very much going through civil war. So that is, unfortunately, the main characteristic today. Congo is very much what we call in the United Nations, a failed state at this moment.
Leopold II's struggle for a colony came at the cost of nearly 10 million African lives. The irony of his regime, sacrificing one group of people for the prosperity of another, has left a permanent scar in Congolese history. Although seldom visited and often ignored by modern society, the story of King Leopold II's life gives exclamation to the 45,000 deaths that still occur each month, as his shadow continues to linger over the Congo today.
So, in conclusion to this, a lot of this colonization of Africa was only basically for money, for power, pretty much like when the United States was colonized, you know, people came, Europeans came over here, they saw the resources, they exploited the resources, you know, They made money off the resources. They took whatever they wanted. They took the land. They took the resources. You know, they killed the people that were here. So basically, colonization of Africa is kind of like what happened in the United States. And I didn't talk a whole lot about the other colonies of Africa. I wanted to concentrate more on King Leopold because I want to talk about the things that he was responsible for. Because, like I said earlier, we don't talk about what he did, you know, in school. And it's history. Children should know. People should know about it. But like I said, it's one of those subjects that got pushed up under the rug and nobody wants to talk about it. So I would suggest to you, you know, a lot of this stuff. And I will tell you, and I don't mind telling you, I'm not an expert. I'm not a professor. I'm not a scholar or any of that. I'm just a regular guy that likes to read history. If I present a show and I try to present shows that have facts, I research the topics. I try to find the truth about everything I talk about. If at any time you hear me talking about a topic and you're not sure what I'm talking about or you don't believe what I'm saying, feel free to research it. Everybody walks around with a computer in their pocket, disguised as a phone. Feel free to Google, Wikipedia, whatever you want to do, and research the topics I'm talking about. That's how I came up with King Leopold, because if I hadn't researched that, I'd have never found out about this guy because I didn't know anything about him. We never talked about this guy in school. So now you know. And if you want to know more, research him whenever you got the time. Because, matter of fact, when I was getting those questions last week, well, not questions, but comments or whatever, somebody saying that he was a great leader and all this other the nonsense, I was going to talk about this guy. I was going to talk about Leopold anyway. But I want to save that for this week. And I hope whoever sent those questions in, comments or whatever, I hope they heard the show tonight. Because, you know, I didn't make this stuff up. I gave you the facts on King Leopold, and he was not a great leader by any stretch of the imagination. So, we have about 30 minutes left. If anybody has any questions or comments, I got the chat room open. I think this is the right one. But matter of fact, Brother Maurice had some questions and stuff for me. So, Brother Mo, you still there? I think I lost Brother Maurice. So I guess what I'll do, I'll stick around for a few minutes because I wanted to kind of end the clips and the topic right around this time so I could answer questions. What I'm going to start doing from now on in the shows, I'm going to try to end at a reasonable time so I can take your questions and your comments because the show is scheduled from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Sometimes we may run over sometimes, but the only thing with that is that if we run over sometimes, the computer automatically cuts me off. You know, sometimes it'll let me go longer, sometimes it won't. And I don't want to get into answering a question or, you know, comment or whatever, and then all of a sudden the show just ends, you know, just gets cut off. So what I want to do now toward like maybe the last 30 minutes of the show, answer your questions, answer your comments, you know, have a little dialogue. If you have any questions, you know, I'll answer any questions. But I do prefer the questions that are reasonable, that are questions, because I have noticed, and unfortunately, and if I don't have any more questions, I'll say this and then I'll go ahead and end the show for this week. With all the things going on in the country, there are a lot of what they call internet trolls. If you're on social media like I am, you know, we'll have people saying stupid things and, you know, just being ridiculous. Those are trolls. And we do have our own trolls here at the Initiative Radio Network. We have a Facebook page, and we do have hundreds of people, thousands of people, you know, they get on, you know, they read, look at the memes, look at the pictures, you know, comments or whatever, because we're trying to keep it 100. We're trying to keep it out there because the information that we're talking about, we need to talk about it. But we do have people on our page that the only reason why they're there is because they want to be trolls. They want to cause trouble. They want to be instigators. And I don't like trolls. I'm not going to run from trolls, so I don't have any problem with trolls. But best believe that, you know, if you have something stupid to say or something, you know, and if I see it, I will answer you back. I will not run away from your asinine comments or anything like that. My thing is, if we're going to have a positive discussion about these issues, we need to talk about these issues like adults and not like 15-year-old kids like President-elect seems to be. I think the only reason why he's on Twitter at 3 o'clock in the morning, I mean, most 15-year-olds, either they're on internet, either playing Xbox One or on social media or looking for porn. But this guy's on Twitter at 3 a.m. in the morning. Aye, aye, aye. So, like I said, you know, if you have any questions about, you know, the topics, whatever, you know, I'll answer the questions. I'm not going to run from them. But, you know, let's be all adults, you know. Like I said earlier, there are people in this country that don't want to talk about these issues. They want to run from them, but I'm not going to run from them. I'm going to present them. We're going to talk about them. Because I think the new racism now is to pretend that racism doesn't exist. And so I'm going to talk about these issues. You know, it may make some people uncomfortable. Well, so be it. I mean, that's not my fault. But they do need to be talked about. In order for us to solve the problem, we need to find the problem, identify the problem, and try to figure it out. You know, instead of pretending that the problems don't exist, you know, we're not going to solve anything. And to tell black people to quit talking about racism and all that kind of stuff, you know, we're not going to do that. Let's see. I think we got a call coming in. Let me see if I can grab this call. Hello, caller. Are you there? Going once. Hello, caller. Are you there? Guess not. Call dropped. But, okay, since Brother Maurice, you still there? I think Brother Maurice's call dropped, too. Wow. Okay, well, I guess on that note, I'm going to end the program. But if you still have questions or whatever, keep submitting them. Either what I'll do is I'll try to answer them next week. Or if you want to, you can get on our Facebook page, Initiative Radio Network. We're on Facebook. Have any questions or comments, feel free to put them there, and I will try to answer as many of them as I can. Next week, I am planning on doing a show about the real story of Christmas and Kwanzaa, since we have Christmas coming up in a couple of weeks. And then I think what I'll do is the last show of the year, we're going to do a recap of the year 2016. And I haven't got all that show fleshed out just yet, but what I want to do in the last show is just go back over things that happened during the year. I may just put together a little end of the year party mix of some, music to, say Hasta La Barba to 2016. So I may do that. I may not, but I'll let you know. So until next week, we're going to talk about the real story of Christmas and Kwanzaa. Until then, I will see you next week. Peace out. Be good. Bye.